there, it's Frank Buckley. Today we have a guest who's known for a number of different things, from his books to a video of an interview that's gone viral to his podcast, or maybe you know him for his writing for TV or his hosting on TV. My guest is Reza Aslan, who at his core is a religious scholar and author. His books include New York Times bestsellers like God, A Human History, and Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza is a Muslim and an Iranian-American who came to America with his family when he was a boy. He converted to Christianity as a teenager and then went back to Islam as an adult. He's a fascinating person. And now he's hosting a program on a new streaming service called Topic. Reza is interviewing other writers on his show called Rough Draft. You'll hear more about that in a moment. Here's my conversation with Reza Aslan.
Reza, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
We know you for so many things. Let's just tick them off. Best-selling author, number one best-selling New York Times best-selling author for Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, among other books. Religious scholar, TV writer, producer, TV host.
Yeah.
host of the podcast, Metaphysical Milkshake.
Yeah, with Rainn Wilson.
With Rainn Wilson. Mm-hmm. We know you as a guy who lost his job at CNN for a tweet.
Yes.
About President Trump.
That's me, all right.
And subject of what's been described as the most embarrassing Fox News interview ever.
Yes.
And not on your part, but it was embarrassing to watch, and people should watch it if they want to know what we're talking about.
Well, now that you bring it up, it makes me think I should start to focus a little more.
No, but you're a lot of things, and I want to sort of cut through all of that public stuff and get to who you are and where it all comes from. And you live here in L.A.
I do, yes.
You were born in Iran.
That's right.
And I was reading, you came to the U.S. at a young age, you told me—
7 years old.
7 years old. And you wrote somewhere that you converted to Christianity as a kid.
Yeah.
You said it was your "you belong here" card.
That's right,
Tell me about that time in your life.
Well, you know, my family wasn't very religious. I mean, we were Muslim in the way that so many people are just sort of culturally religious. But when we left Iran in 79 and came to the U.S., basically just when the Iran hostage crisis started, this was a time in which being Muslim in America was a very dangerous thing to be, as opposed to now when it's fantastic. Everything's great now. But, you know, the early 80s, it was very difficult. And so I think as a family, we kind of made a conscious decision to separate ourselves as much as possible from our culture, our heritage, certainly our religion. I've admitted on numerous occasions that I spent a good part of the 1980s pretending to be Mexican, which tells you how little I understand America, because it didn't help at all. But I think for me, I'd always had this deep longing for spiritual fulfillment, spiritual edification. I was very interested in religion. Partly it may have had to do with my childhood experiences of revolutionary Iran. I mean, you don't often get that sort of firsthand look at how religion can transform a society for good and for bad. But I didn't really have an opportunity to express it. And it wasn't until high school that I went to an evangelical youth camp where I discovered Christianity, and a particularly conservative brand of Christianity. And I don't want to pretend that this wasn't an emotional decision. I was really affected by the gospel story, as so many people are. But I also can't pretend that there wasn't some aspect of a desire to just simply belong.
Yeah.
You know, I always joke that in America, it doesn't matter how funny your name is or what color your skin is. If you love Jesus, you're American. And I wanted to be American. I wanted to feel American.
Yeah. And I just wonder, how did your family react to that?
Well, so my dad has always been skeptical of religion, but the Iranian Revolution turned skepticism into full-blown hatred. So for him, he just thought, wait a second, we came to America so you wouldn't have to be religious, and now you're choosing to be religious. So for him, it was all very frustrating. I did, however, do exactly what I was mandated to do by my new faith, which was to convert everybody I could meet.
Right.
So I did convert my mother, who's still a very faithful Christian to this day.
Right.
I converted my sister, who has left Christianity. But I think, you know, for them, they understood that I was yearning for a deeper meaning. And it was, by the way, that meaning, that sense of longing that then created the trajectory of my entire career. I went to college and decided to study religion for a living. that experience was very much the same experience that I think a lot of people in college have, where you suddenly realize, oh, everything I know is wrong. I see. Yes. Everything that I have been told is a lie.
Right.
That's, you know, first year of college for pretty much everyone. But in my case, you know, there was a religious aspect to that. And so I decided to study the religions of the world while still maintaining a spiritual path of my own.
Yeah. And I want to go back to something you said a moment ago, and that is this idea of Iran and your father being skeptical of religion.
Right.
And as I told you before, I've been to Iran
in
just a few days, but I had so many preconceived notions about what Iran is, who Iranians are, how they feel about us. And every Iranian I met wanted to engage with me, wanted to tell me how much they don't hate me.
Yes.
Because we have this feeling that Iranian people hate us and that they must all have participated in the revolution. And that's not the case.
You know, in more general terms, I think this brings out something very fascinating about how Americans understand their relationship between the population and the government. See, in our country, as a free and open democracy, as best as we can, the assumption is whether you voted for the current government or not, that government represents you. For Iranians, the government does not represent them in the slightest. I mean, it just the idea that the government is a representation of the popular will would never occur to most Iranians,
right,
even those Iranians who support the government.
Hmm.
For us, when we see the government of Iran making, you know, certain outrageous anti-American sentiments, for instance, we assume that that is a reflection of the population. But of course, it's not. It couldn't be anything further. What's fascinating, however, is that when Iranians hear Donald Trump, for instance, speak, it never occurs to them that Donald Trump is reflecting the will of the American people.
Mm.
That's so foreign to them. Mm. And so when you go to Iran, you find far greater openness.
Yeah.
They love American culture, American people. They are able to make a distinction between the American government and the American people in a way that we, because of the irony of the fact that we live in a democracy, don't in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
But as most people know, Iranians represent an extraordinarily young population, very sophisticated,
very
well-educated,
educated,
globalized population. I mean, obviously, the current regime in Iran has done a pretty good job of trying to maintain the isolation of the Iranian people, shutting down the internet, for instance, recently.
Mm.
But it doesn't work.
Yeah.
This population is more tech savvy and more sophisticated than the government is, and so they know what's going on around the world. They understand what's happening, and they know what they want.
Yeah. You are, as I said a moment ago, a resident of Los Angeles. You live in a place where there are many people of Persian.
Oh, we call this Tarangeles.
That's right. And and so there is, I feel like, as in all immigrant populations who have left mm-hmm. a country, there is a longing amongst many of the people in that population for what once was.
Right.
And to the friends and family they've left behind. And especially when it's an immigrant population who are kept from their loved ones. And I just wondered, can you speak to that and what it's like to be an Iranian American, seeing what your friends and family who are behind are
right.
subject to and
yeah.
what that pain is like?
Well, first let me begin by saying there is something unique about the Iranian American experience, particularly here in Southern California, where I believe there is, by some estimates, something like 300,000 Iranian Americans. And partly that has to do with the way in which the two waves of immigrations here happened. There was a first wave before the fall of the Shah, and that was primarily the upper class Iranians, those who had some association with the government, those who were able to leave with, you know, their Swiss bank accounts attacked. And then the second wave of Iranians, those who actually took part in the anti-imperialist revolution against the Shah, but then realized what came after it wasn't what they were hoping for and then got the heck out, like my family did.
Mm.
So there is a real political divide here, and there's a generational divide, of course. The vast majority of Iranian Americans now were born after the revolution. They are first generation Iranians, like my sister. And I think for them, they are quite fascinated by Iran. They long for a country that they have no connection to. And for the most part, they are deeply skeptical, if not just outright rejecting the sort of the much more conservative, if you will, politics of their parents. Most of the older generation of Iranians in Southern California have, and my father was one of these, so I speak from personal experience, have an enormous amount of anger and resentment and hatred at the current regime because they feel like it took their country away from them. It took their family away from them. It's oppressing the people in Iran, all of which is true, and tend to feel as though the proper response is a much more muscular American foreign policy, one that squeezes that country, that sanctions it, and even that responds militarily. There is a far greater enthusiasm for a military response among older Iranian Americans here than I think most people would realize. So there's a generational divide. There's a political divide. There's a divide insofar as the immigration and socioeconomic status. It's a very divided community. And it's a community that unfortunately has a very difficult time uniting in moments like this, moments in which Iranians are out on the street clamoring for the most basic rights and privileges. Iranian Americans who have a voice are divided. We can't come together and unite in a single voice of support for our friends and family suffering on the street, because we're constantly going at each other. We can't remove politics from the situation. It's truly tragic. I think I have to be honest with you that a large part of I get a lot of hatred from a lot of corners, but a lot of the hatred that I get comes from my own co-nationalists here in the U.S. who feel as
even
though,
amongst your generation and younger,
even amongst some in my generation who feel as though my explicit call for openness and negotiation and greater dialogue with the Iranian regime rather than the current course that we're in is some sort of capitulation or that I'm some kind of secret agent for the Iranian regime. We hear these things all the time. It's really sad. I think the if we could, the Iranian American community here, actually put that behind us, we could be a real force for change in Iran.
One thing I imagine all of those immigrants, Iranian Americans, this is the last question I'm going to ask about this because I don't want this to be just about this. You have a wonderful new program about writing that I want to get to in a moment. But the one thing that I suspect all of you have in common is this experience of coming here, being proud Americans, being happy to be here, to be away from that, whatever that was, to that person, and then being subject to this new discrimination here, like, oh, you're one of those guys who took the hostages.
Right.
When that could be the furthest from the truth. That, especially for your parents' generation, that must be a particular pain.
It was. I mean, I remember in the 1980 having protests on my street. I remember banks refusing to cash my father's paychecks because his ID said that he was born in Iran. I remember going to elementary school and seeing my fellow students wear shirts that said bomb Iran and my teachers wearing those little yellow ribbons in solidarity with the hostages. It was an ever-present experience, this notion that you are other, you are foreign, you are enemy. And it's one, unfortunately, that hasn't dissipated. It's still around. I mean, you just look at the travel ban that this new administration has been enacting, which has had devastating consequences in the lives of Iranians who should be our greatest allies, who are people who are really on our side in this divide between America and Iran. My hope is that we are going to look at a future in which finally we see an opportunity for some kind of normalization of relations, if not even rapprochement. I do see that coming. I just think that we have to understand that it's going to happen in very slow increments, that the desire amongst Iranians in Iran for some kind of revolution, some kind of tearing down of the government and starting over again, is not as great as a lot of Iranian American activists here in the United States like to pretend that it is.
You mentioned that some of this context drove you to think about religion.
Absolutely.
And you go to university and you decide to make this your thing. And you spend the next two decades studying religion.
That's right.
And among the things is the book that we mentioned at the top, Zealot. And when you were out with this book, which became a number one bestseller, there were some people who immediately went after you because they said, yes, you had converted to Christianity, but then back to Islam.
That's right.
And said, well, a Muslim is writing about Jesus of Nazareth. Why? How could you? And without even reading it.
Yeah. Well, look, when you write about religion for a living, you're writing about something that people take pretty seriously.
Yeah.
because religion, I think it's important to understand, is far more than just a matter of beliefs and practices. Religion is a matter of identity. When someone says, I am Muslim or I am Jewish or I am Hindu or Christian, they're not making a faith statement. They're making an identity statement. Mm. And as an identity statement, it is enwrapped in how they see themselves. And so when someone shows up, whether within the community or outside of the community, and questions some basic assumptions or perhaps contradicts some basic orthodoxy, it doesn't feel like their faith is being attacked. It feels like their very identity is being attacked. And that's why so often the response is extreme and even violent. I get that. And I've spent the last two decades speaking about religion, my religion, everyone else's religion, with a level of respect and honor that I feel that it deserves. At the same time, particularly when it comes to a figure like Jesus, people tend to take Jesus kind of seriously.
Yeah.
Who knew? I think
you
for
knew.
Yeah, I knew.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding.
Just so
I knew.
People understand that you're kidding.
Yes. I think for a lot of people, when they think of Jesus, they think of him purely in terms as the incarnate God. And so when someone shows up and says, hey, okay, that's fine, but you know, Jesus was also a man, meaning he lived in a particular time and place, meaning that that time and place kind of matters, that the context, the historical context in which he lived matters, that he was actually speaking to a specific audience, that kind of matters. And when you put all those things together, it sort of changes his message. All you hear is the context part. Because think about it. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of thought about this, but if you think Jesus is literally God, what does context have to do with anything?
Mm-hmm.
He's not speaking to a specific audience. He's speaking to me right now.
Mm-hmm.
His actions aren't historically relevant. They are universal and eternal. And so the very notion that you can talk about someone called the historical Jesus right then and there, I think turns off an entire audience.
Mm.
I get that. I will say one thing that probably there's a lot of things that have been satisfying about the experience of publishing this book, but probably the most satisfying part about it is how many lapsed Christians come up to me and say, this brought me back to Christianity.
Hmm.
That if I knew this Jesus when I was a kid, I wouldn't have left. Now, that was obviously not my point. I wasn't trying to do that.
Right.
But it is very satisfying to hear.
Because you wrote about a Jesus who was not just a religious figure as we know him today. It's not the Jesus that, you know, I was taught in church or Sunday school. This is the man, as you said, who was a political figure.
And a product of his time.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
And he, this idea of crucifixion, you don't say he wasn't crucified. You say, yes, he was crucified. And that was reserved for a certain kind of person.
That's right. Crucifixion was a punishment that Rome reserved explicitly for sedition against the state. There was no other crime for which one could be crucified. Crucifixion wasn't necessarily a death penalty. I mean, yes, you died. ultimately, you ended up dead. But that wasn't the point. There were a lot of ways to kill you. Mm-hmm. The point of crucifixion was to serve as a deterrent against rebellion, mm-hmm. which is why crucifixions were done publicly, in the open, in marketplaces, in Golgotha, which is a hill right at the main entrance of Jerusalem. You cannot enter Jerusalem without first passing hundreds of crucified people who were all crucified for a single act, rebellion against Rome. So yes, what the book does is it starts with that one fact. It starts with why was he crucified? And then it uses that plus the world in which he lived, an incredibly politically turbulent time, to construct a biography of Jesus, the man, which I think is much more historically accurate than what we have in the Gospels, because the Gospels don't treat Jesus like a man. The Gospels treat him like the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And so they begin with that assumption. And so the stories there are all meant, they're proof texts, if you will. Mm. They're meant to prove a conclusion that they already have about him. It's extraordinarily difficult to get through that and find the real Jesus, but it's not impossible. It's been happening for a couple of centuries now.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
The journey that you started when you went to university to think carefully about religion and to study it, did you find the answers that you were looking for?
No, but what I found was something way more important, which is I discovered that the question's more important than the answer. Mm. That the journey is more important than the destination. Mm. That, you know, and indeed, I think all of my works have that assumption that really what really matters is asking the right question and then pursuing that as far as you can until you can make a pretty well-educated guess based on the information that's available. Sometimes when it comes to a figure like Jesus or a figure like Muhammad or a figure like Moses, that's the best you can get is a really well-educated guess.
Right. That some people are going to disagree with. And I think that was part of your point as well. As a religious scholar, you said, here is my argument. Here is the picture that I see. And you welcome people to say,
yeah,
well, that's not the picture I see.
That's right.
But it was the hatred with which people responded that, I don't know, I found shocking. I don't know about you, but it seemed
get used to it.
There was vitriol to it.
Yes. There's an enormous amount of vitriol. But again, I think that's because people feel as though you are attacking them. Mm-hmm. You're attacking how they understand themselves, how they view themselves in an indeterminate world, their very sense of self. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's not just religion that does this. You know, when you make certain assumptions about national identity or ethnic or racial identity, I mean, these are identities that have led to devastating world wars, as the same as with religion. People tend to get very bristly when they feel like their identity is at stake.
Let me move from that to this program that you're now hosting. And it's called Rough Draft.
That's right.
It's on the streaming service Topic.
Topic, that's right, yes.
And as a writer, as a best-selling writer, as a TV writer, you're mm-hmm. you're an executive producer of a couple of shows that have been commissioned, 1001 Nights.
That's right,
being adapted for film, TV, and gaming content. Mm-hmm. You're on Chuck Lorre's next big
Chuck
thing
Lorre's
on CBS.
Next project, which is exciting. Yeah.
Which is The United States of Al, about a Marine back from Afghanistan struggling to readjust to life in Ohio and his Afghan interpreter who comes to live in the U.S.
Very which excited is a, about that one.
Which is a real story that is happening
right
now. And as a professor of creative writing UC Riverside, you come at writing from a place of being there, of knowledge, of being in that room alone and with others in a writing room. And so when you sit down with writers face to face, what do you, how do you interview them differently than I might interview them?
Well, I think, you know, coming at it precisely as you say, from someone who's had the experience on the inside, you know, I feel like I know intimately what writers struggle with, how they get their thoughts on paper, how they feel about talking about writing. I think a lot of people don't realize how much writers love to talk about writing. Really, honestly, anything not to actually write, any excuse we'll take. And I always thought that the thing about writers is, you know, we when we write about things, we immerse ourselves in the political and cultural conversations that are taking place. We want to be a part of that. And so this show is not just a show about writing. Mm. It's about it's a current events show, really. It's a talk show. It's just that we deal with it from a very unique lens, you know, from writers who are very much immersing themselves in these cultural conversations. This was a show that originally began in LA as a live program. We were all very big fans of Inside the Actor's Studio.
Yeah.
And we thought, what if we had like something like Inside the Actor's Studio,
writers.
But for writers, but in a nightclub with a live band and everybody's drunk. And we started doing this live, and it became so popular that it became a short-lived first season show on a cable network called Ovation. And then now it's becoming something new in topic. And, you know, what's really fun about it, besides the fact that it's fun and funny and entertaining and, you know, the drinks are flowing pretty freely, I have to imagine. And the show gets funnier and funnier and more entertaining the more drinks we start having, is that writers fundamentally are tackling the human condition. Mm. And there's an enormous amount of emotion and struggle and challenge and conflict that's involved in that process. And I think watching that be expressed is not just interesting and edifying and entertaining, but it's also enormously encouraging. I think the best comment that I have received from people who have either come to the live show or who have seen the TV version of it is that it makes them want to go out and be creative. Mm. It, you know, that they think like, I can do this too. I can go, I can be creative, not just necessarily in writing, but in other parts of my life. And that I think is ultimately what we're rooting for is to get an audience that feels as though they can do this. They can go out there and do something meaningful.
You've had great success as a writer, but there are so many other people out there who are just spending hour after hour behind the keyboard. And they're not having the success that you've had. And I wonder, is there anything that you would say to them that would encourage them, or is it sort of a locked system? Are they out of it? Are they?
You know, I'm really glad.
Out?
I'm glad you asked this question. We spend a lot of time in these shows giving advice. You know, things like that. We have a 5 questions that we say, like, you know, what's the best advice that you can give? What's the worst advice you've ever gotten? Things like that.
Yeah.
But I think the 2 things that I would say to a young struggling writer is, first and foremost, writers write. Right. And I know it sounds obvious, but I think so many young writers, and I teach them, so I get it. So many young writers think that writing is a kind of art, and that as an art, it requires the muses to inspire you into a moment when suddenly it all comes out. And so I will just wait until that mystical experience finally grips me. There's no other industry in which you do this. You can't, you know, you don't say,
I don't
well,
get
I'm,
to say,
yeah,
right.
yeah, I'm only going to do this interview if the spirit moves me to do it. No, it's your job. You punch in, you do it.
Right.
And what I always tell my students is, if you don't treat writing like a job, it'll never be your job. So it's a grind. You sit down, you punch the clock, you sit in front of that computer and you do your allotted hours, and then you know, whether it's good or bad, you did it. The next day, you do it over again.
Yeah.
And then for those who feel as though I am doing this, I am working, and I just don't feel like I'm getting there. You know, there's something that V.S. Naipaul, the great Nobel Prize-winning author who unfortunately passed a little while ago, said, which may be true, maybe not true, but I like to believe that it's true. He said that in the end, talent always wins. Mm. So, right, I get it. You're sitting there and you're feeling like I'm doing it well. Everything around me is garbage and I feel like I'm doing it well. Why aren't people noticing? I think Naipaul is right that keep going, because in the end, talent always wins.
Someone will notice it.
Just yeah. keep grinding.
That's not the right way to put it, but if it's something that other people will want to read,
right.
see, hear, someone will notice
yes.
that because they're in the marketplace.
Exactly.
And they know that.
Just keep grinding,
yeah.
keep producing, keep putting it out there. It will get noticed.
About your process when you write, and obviously you do different types of writing. So you say, if you're a writer, write. Right now you're sitting here wasting time with me.
I know. What am I doing?
And there must be, are there moments, do you have a routine that you fall into? I wake up at 4 a.m. and I write for 3 hours and I
right.
have breakfast, whatever. What is
well,
that?
So I, because I do so many other things, write in seasons. Mm. So usually what happens is I'll pull out the 2020 calendar right around now, honestly, and look at it and sort of map out, you know, the seasons, like these 3 or 4 months right here. Those will be my writing months.
Wow.
And during those months, yes, I write every day. I wake up, I have breakfast, I take the kids to work, I sit down and I write until it's time
work?
To pick up.
Yeah, <that's laughs> you take them to school.
I take the kids
right.
to school.
Right.
Yes, my 8-year-olds. You know, you gotta, you know, if you want to live in the house, you gotta right. contribute. Take them to school and then I sit down and I write, and that's, you know, every day, 9 to 3, Monday through Friday. And the reason I say this is because creativity, it's kind of like a muscle. You know, when you talk to elite athletes, when you talk to elite runners, for instance, they will tell you that they have a very strict calendar.
Yeah.
I wake up, I eat this, I run at exactly 9 a.m., and then I stop, and then I do this, and I do it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And what any athlete, any trainer will tell you is that what you're doing is training your muscles.
Right.
So that what happens is that eventually your muscles know that it's 9 a.m. on a Tuesday. I know it's a magical thing, but it knows and it begins to prepare for itself to the point where some athletes will tell you that if they miss a 9 a.m., they'll get cramps. Their muscles will cramp up because their muscle thinks it's 9 a.m.
I'm supposed to be running.
Let's do this.
Yeah.
The brain works very much in the same way. Mm. When you have trained yourself to be creative at 9 a.m. every Tuesday, let's say, eventually your brain turns on at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday. And I've actually had this experience, much like athletes do, where for some reason that 9 a.m. at Tuesday showed up and I couldn't write. And my brain it's not functioning. I can't make a sandwich because my brain is on this other level where it's trying to be creative. So that's why schedules matter. It's prosaic, it's utilitarian, and it's obvious. But if you were going to say, what's the one bit of advice, the best advice that I could give? Writing schedule. Get a writing schedule and stick to it, and you will see a transformation in your output.
In terms of your output, what's next in terms of books? And I sort of touched on some
right.
of the TV stuff and the other content, but what's next for you?
Well, the two things that I'm most excited about and that are sort of right on my plate right now, in terms of books, is my next book was announced a few months ago. I'm writing a biography of a young man by the name of Howard Baskerville. Mm. Howard Baskerville in 1907 graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary, and instead of, you know, going back to South Dakota and following in the footsteps of his father and his brothers and his grandfather and becoming a Presbyterian minister, he decided that he would want an adventure first and got a job teaching English and history and preaching the gospel in Tabriz, Iran.
Right.
Showed up in 1907, just in time for a revolution.
and was killed.
Yes, indeed. He joined the revolution. He transformed his class into a militia and gave up his American citizenship, gave up his post in the Presbyterian Church, and led his students in a revolution against the Shah, a revolution that ultimately resulted in the creation of a constitution and the first parliament in Iran, and died doing so. He is a heroic figure in Iran, sometimes referred to as Iran's Lafayette. There's a bust of him in Tabriz. His grave is still a pilgrimage site in Tabriz. When I was a kid in Iran, there were more than one or two, as far as I remember, elementary schools called Howard Baskerville Elementary School. And yet no American knows who this kid is. This is literally the first English language biography of him. And so that's what I'm engaged in now. I've also sold the film rights to it, and I'm writing the screenplay as well. And then also now we are moving forward with the film version of Zealot. It's a screenplay that I wrote with James Shamus, a great Oscar caliber screenwriter, frequent collaborator with Ang Lee. And it's being produced by David Heyman, who produced the Harry Potter movies and most recently Once Upon a Time in
Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I saw the movie twice. I don't know why I can't. Right. I apologize, David. I'm really excited about that. I think that's going to be a really exciting new take on a story that I think we've seen before, but never quite like this.
Yeah. Well, Reza, this has really been a pleasure. I really wish you well, and we'll look forward to seeing and reading what you come up with.
Thank you very much. And download the Topic streamer. It's anywhere that you find, you know, any other streamer, Netflix, Disney Plus, Rough Draft. Premieres on December 5th.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to see my conversation with Reza Aslan, check out Frank Buckley Interviews on KTLA on weekends. It airs on Saturday at 8:30 p.m. and Sunday at midnight. We also post the show to YouTube after it airs on TV. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and we have more than 175 episodes in our archives with fascinating people. And of course, it's always free to listen. Thanks for listening this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.